Tonight I'd like to speak about the strong tendency that one may have to try to avoid difficulties or to push away what is conditioning us. In one sutra, the Buddha said to his disciples, while gathered around him, at the end of the day, it seemed that it was his habit to teach by the end of the day, he told the nuns and monks who were there, it is impossible to travel to the end of the world. Then he told them, without traveling to the end of the world, it is not possible to reach freedom. Then he went away. I think it's a very nice way of teaching. Imagine how much trust is given to the students, to the disciples. Well, actually they went to ask Ananda. They thought that was maybe a bit difficult for them, so they went to ask Ananda what he thought about that. And Ananda, to help them a little bit, said that the world was the eye, form, and eye consciousness. Ears, sound, and hearing consciousness. He described the five sense, organ, object, and consciousness. And he said also the mind, thoughts, and mental consciousness. So he gave them something to be able to meditate with. And in another sutra we find something quite similar. The Buddha is teaching some of his disciples, and Mara, the devil, see that and he's not so happy. He says, that's not so good. The Buddha is transmitting wisdom and those people are going to understand. So he wanted to come and disturb what was happening. So he came in the aspect of a farmer, came close to the Buddha and said, have you seen my oxen? He asked the Buddha, have you seen my oxen? But the Buddha immediately recognized him. And he said, the devil one, what are your oxen? So what is your property? What is your belonging? What is your domain? And Mara said, the eye, the eyes, form, eye consciousness. Those belong to me. Where can you go to escape me? He said, ears, sounds, and hearing consciousness. Those belong to me. Where can you go to escape me? So he mentioned the five sense organs, object, and consciousness. He said, where can you go to escape me? The mind, thoughts and images, mental consciousness, those belong to me. Where can you go to escape me? So he has described all the world, actually, what he is telling the Buddha. And of course, I imagine the disciple listening carefully there, that he has mentioned all the world, all the experience, and he said, where can you go to escape me? And the Buddha acknowledged, he said, yes, eyes form eye consciousness. They belong to you. So clearly the world of form, consciousness, object, that the world of Mara, that the world of illusion, they belong to you. But he says, when there is no eyes, no form, no eye consciousness, there you cannot go. When there is no ears, no sound, no hearing consciousness, there you cannot go. When there is no mind, no thoughts, no mental consciousness, there you cannot go. So Mara was defeated and went away. Quite an interesting meeting of Mara and the Buddha. But we may try to make sense of that. Mara is understood in different ways. One way to understand Mara usually is he is a symbolization of the kleshas, all the negative mental states, desire, anger, aversion, and we understand the Buddha had to defeat Mara in order to awaken. He had to defeat aversion, desire, confusion, jealousy, all those who were aspects of Mara. He had to defeat them in order to awaken. This is constantly mentioned in the text, but here something slightly different is said, and even something more. your guns, the object, and the consciousness, this is also Mara, and that has also to be overcome. Yet, it is important to remember that the first aspect of Mara also has to be taken into consideration, that the desire, aversion, and all the negative mental states also have to be overcome. What Mara has mentioned there sometimes is also called nama rupa, which means all what is mental or the mind, what is related to the mind and matter. In one of the earlier texts also it is said, where water, earth, fire and air do not get a footing, here the round no longer revolves, here name and form cease, stop without remainder. It means that is a awakening, state of freedom. So all those aggregate, all those form, we can imagine that's just consciousness and matter. So they have to, in a sense, to disappear, to go away. But what does it mean? And how to accomplish that? How to go to this place where there is no eyes, no form and no eye consciousness, that Mara cannot come there? Which is this place where we can go there, Mara will not be able to come in? And how to go there? There are descriptions in many texts of the path of concentration explaining how one would go away, leave all the perceptions from gross to very subtle. I will just give you a short outline, because that is very traditional in the Buddhist text, and to understand that. So there are 8 stages of concentration. And all those stages of concentration, they go from first being concerned with the external world with the 5 type of perceptions. So the first stage is withdrawing from that. When one comes into meditation to develop concentration, the first thing one is getting away from is not being concerned anymore by seeing, by hearing, by tasting. One withdraws into a quieter place, a place which is not anymore stimulated by all the 5 sense organs. So that's the first withdrawal. And when this withdrawal is reached, then there is a stage of joy and happiness. And it is a very deep stage of concentration. It's not a very light, it's a very deep stage of concentration. So withdrawing from the 5 senses. Then the second stage, one will go deeper in the isolation, in the withdrawal. There is no more discrimination. At this time, there will be a great joy and happiness. Great joy and happiness will arise in the mind as a result of this practice of concentration. At the third stage, the meditator will renounce the joy, not grasp joy, the joy aspect of the experience, and there will be only a higher type of happiness at the third stage. And it is said that in all different type of life, this is the highest happiness that anyone could ever experience. There is no higher happiness than this one, third stage. It's the peak of all existence with respect to happiness. But to go deeper, the meditator will have to get rid of the clinging or attachment to this experience of higher happiness. And it is often said that it is difficult to go from the third to the fourth, so attracting is this higher type of happiness. And the meditator will need to develop the sense of equanimity in order to go deeper. We see in this movement, first there was a disregarding of the 5 sense object, then there were some kind of experience, inner experience. They have got deeper and deeper, certain type of happiness, that even that is being disregarded, not being attached to any type of experiences. So when one goes beyond this type of highest happiness, one has reached the fourth of the dhyana, the fourth stage. But the meditator will understand that there is some aspect which is still gross in the experience, and they will move on a deeper and more subtle aspect of concentration. They will now go beyond matter, resistance and multiplicity. That what is the first one in the first stage, it was going beyond the five sense object and happiness. And the four next one, it is beyond matter, resistance and multiplicity. So the first object of concentration will be space. The meditator will just concentrate on space, nothing else. But he still will understand that space is slightly gross, so he will meditate on consciousness, subtle concept of consciousness. But he will understand that it is still slightly gross, he will meditate on nothingness. Understanding that there is still something slightly gross with respect to that, he will reach the last stage, which is neither perception nor non-perception. That is the highest stage and deepest stage of withdrawal that one may reach. We may imagine in space nothing much is happening, in nothingness nothing even less is happening, and in the stage of neither perception nor non-perception, that is the total withdrawal. At this time, there is no ears, sound consciousness, no eyes, no form, no shape, no seeing consciousness. We could say there Mara cannot go, because there is nothing with which Mara could delude the mind of this meditator. Nothing is appearing there, so how could he be mistaken in a sense? So is it what the Buddha had in mind when he taught this, and when he was entering Mara? Is it what he had in mind? Does it mean that the path to avoid Mara is to go along this line where one will withdraw more and more and more to a stage of complete withdrawal? Is it what the Buddha has in mind when he speaks about cessation of suffering or the overcoming of Mara? In many texts, the Buddha said that some meditators mistake this stage, this experience, for freedom. And that has not to be mistaken. It's in that the Buddha, when he first went through a training, he started to meditate on those eight aspects. And Sariputra and Moggallana also meditate on those. But they understood that was not the end of suffering. That was just a withdrawal, some kind of holiday, deep holiday, no problem. But the problem are not solved. They are just put aside. One has just withdraw from the problem. One is avoiding the problem. But that also points out to one understanding when we may imagine that emptiness or whatever name we like to play with means the negating of everything, the tendency that we may have to understand voidness, emptiness or whatever in this sense, it is pointing out that is a wrong understanding. We believe that we have in our practice to make an empty mind. There, the technique to make an empty mind may take about 60 years, I don't know, or maybe 500 lifetimes. Those practices are very difficult, but there is certainly a very precise path to empty the mind. But that does not lead to freedom. That certainly leads to a very deep state of concentration that could be used later on for the development of wisdom, but within themselves they are not the development of wisdom. All the development of concentration are always a withdrawal. This is just a way of explaining to the ultimate aspect of this withdrawal. And why is that not ultimate freedom? They do not seem to remind much problem in this situation. You know. No perception, no non-perception. Doesn't seem that there is much room for problem there. So why is it not freedom? We have to question, then what has happened to that which has been left outside? To all the sounds, to all the form, to all the shapes, to all the sensations, to all that, what has happened to them? Where are they? They are there, all around. As soon as a meditator will leave her or his state of concentration, deep concentration, they will be there, with exactly the same quality of solidity, of true reality. He has not understood what they are. He has just avoided them. He has not looked at them. He has not understood them. So all the aspect of what has been negated, of what the meditator has freed himself or herself from, still there, waiting for him or for her. So that does not correspond to any freedom. The freedom of nirvana, as is mentioned in the text, is the unborn, deathless, the unconditioned. So what does it mean then? If we want, that was just an example of a path that may lead us to some kind of situation that could have been mistaken for freedom. But we may imagine other type of paths, trying to get rid of emotion, trying to get rid of negative states of mind. So we may try now to find another path, maybe more subtle, that will lead us little by little to a stage of ultimate freedom, that will lead us little by little to situation of unconditioned, to experience the unconditioned. But if we were to follow any type of path, even if it would be different from this one, that we will little by little get rid of this aspect or that aspect, or bring some causes in order to bring some result that we may be looking for, this result that we will call nirvana. In this view, this manner of seeing the path, it means that after cultivation of cause and condition, when all those will be fulfilled, then we will reach something that we should call the unconditioned, the unborn. But obviously, how is it possible that we will lead to a situation of unconditioned? Unconditioned means not depending on cause, not depending on condition. How is it possible that our reaching or the establishment of this unconditioned state will be depending on cultivation of cause and condition? That will not make sense, even if we were to try to find more subtle aspect of the practice. If we were to practice cultivating cause and condition, in order to reach something which is beyond cause and condition, there is at one point a leap that it is not possible to cross. It is not possible to cross from the condition, believing that from a subtle way of working with conditioning, that suddenly we will reach beyond condition. Those two can never be reconciled. There is an impossibility. From our situation in the conditioned world, as we are, it is not possible to manipulate in a very subtle way, very intelligent way. It is not possible to reorganize our outer world or inner world or inner perception or psychology, to reorganize them in order that they will be unconditioned. They will always be depending on our reorganization. So if the aim, the nirvana, is the unconditioned, the uncaused, the unborn, it means that it is completely impossible to reach it. We are in a situation of bondage where it is completely impossible and completely absurd to imagine that we could ever reach a stage of unconditioning. That doesn't make sense. However subtle we may imagine a path, however subtle we may imagine that we will be cultivating cause and condition, but that would be completely impossible. So in our situation, working with cause, with conditions, maybe we would imagine that, or we have to state that this unconditioned nirvana, unborn, is just an impossibility. Just something which is completely impossible. It's completely an illusion to believe that there can be an unconditioned nirvana or cessation. Cannot be reached by cause and condition, doesn't make sense. And if we were not doing anything, that will also not be reached. We'll just stay in the stage of conditioning. So something is strange there. Something is wrong. We all have come here for the unconditioned, for nirvana, and finally there said, well, if we really, really want to see our situation very, very honestly, we see that the unconditioned is just impossible. We came all the way for the unconditioned. So something doesn't work there. And maybe it has to not work. Maybe it should not work. Because what it is said that there is a truth of suffering, all the problems that we may imagine, and we have part of them, and the origin of suffering is ignorance, confusion. Now we are trying with our confused mind, conditioned mind, we are trying within the same framework, trying to find a solution. And that's exactly why we are conditioned, because we are in a causal way, we are completely linked. Now we are using our ignorance as a light to show us the way to the unconditioned. And that's not the proper light to use. So the use of conditioning, the light of conditioning, cultivation of cause and condition, that is not the light that can lead us to the unconditioned. Obviously, this way of seeing the path is exactly why we keep on cycling birth to death and birth and death, because we try to find solution within the framework of conditioning. And as long as we'll try to find solution having the same vision of our situation, trying to deal with them, we still will be in a conditioned situation. Seeing from this point of view of our conditioned situation, the unconditioned seems impossible. But maybe we are mistaken. Maybe our situation is not the true reality, and maybe the reality is the unconditioned. Maybe we are confused. Maybe we are in samsara. And maybe we could consider now, if the unconditioned were the truth, if the unconditioned were the truth, and what would that tell us? If the unconditioned were the truth, and if we were mistaken with respect to our perception, to our belief, if the unconditioned is the truth, what does it mean with respect to the past? If the unconditioned is the truth, or is a possibility, then it means that the unconditioned is also the timeless, the unborn. It means only a path which is in affinity with timelessness, the unborn, the unconditioned, is meaningful, which means a path which is not conditioned, which means a path which is useless. A path which does not lead anywhere, a path which is already the aim. There cannot be any duality between the path and the aim. If there were duality, then we are in time, we are seeing from the condition point of view. So what we are cultivating in such a path, seen from this point of view, we are cultivating the aim, we are practicing the aim. The aim and the path are the same. The practice is a practice of freedom, not a practice for freedom. Only then, if we see from this point of view that being conditioned, may be possible, may be the truth, then at this time it tells us that the condition does not exist truly. It means that we have never been conditioned. That not that we need to get rid of conditioning. That our true nature, our essence, is unconditioned. Only because we believe that we are conditioned, and the more we will try to deal with cause and condition, that will keep us in the state of conditioning. So seeing from the point of view of the aim, of the unconditioned, then we may understand that our conditioned situation is just a fiction. And since we believe in this fiction, then we are conditioned and we suffer. And as long as we will grasp to our conditioned situation and believe that it is a true reality, then we will be suffering. Then we will be conditioned. Because we believe in its reality. Although the word unconditioned is slightly misleading, because unconditioned seems to mean that it leaves apart the condition. It seems to be in the opposition of the condition. So it is a word which is slightly misleading, but we also understand that this, when we use language, when we speak, we are coming from the point of view of the condition, and then we are trying to speak about something which is, in a sense, does not follow the same rules as the condition. Now we try to put words and we call that the unconditioned. That seems to oppose to the condition, but we have seen that since the condition does not exist truly, the unconditioned will not be meaningful. How the unconditioned will be the freedom or cessation from the condition. Since the condition, we have seen that does not exist truly. When we believe it is existing truly, then we are conditioned. If we imagine that the unconditioned require the cessation of the condition, first it means the condition does exist. And that will make the unconditioned depending on the existence of the condition. They will be related. So the unconditioned is, in a sense, when it seems to suggest that it is the eradication or the absence of the condition, is misleading. It's bringing a duality between condition and unconditioned. Duality which does not or cannot exist. That will condition the unconditioned. I came across a notion in a book by Camus, which I thought first was not very skillful, the notion of the absurd. And there were some of the French philosophers maybe speaking about the meaning of life when they were sometimes using the term absurd. I thought that doesn't make much sense. Some people believe it is meaningful and some say it is absurd. But in a sense, to believe that one can give a meaning to life is already try to impose some concept. Life is life, and then as soon as one tries to put some meaningfulness or meaninglessness, that does not make sense. Just applying some kind of concept to something which is. But my understanding was very short, trying to inquire a little bit more in this notion of absurd. So it's a bit the same as with the incondition and the condition, that you are the absurd if you understand the absurd as the contrary of meaningfulness. So it's just a meaning in negation. Life is absurd. But my understanding was very gross. So I want to speak a little bit more about that. That may apply also a little bit about the topic that I am speaking about tonight. So I have questioned the notion of wanting to get rid of the world, as we saw the first understanding of meditation as concentration, trying to meditate in order to withdraw more and more in a deep state of concentration where nothing would appear anymore. So it's cutting oneself from the world. It does not need to be always so complete, but we may understand in our practice when difficulty arises, one may try to withdraw to avoid them or wish they were not there, believing that my spiritual path would be easy if I could avoid all those difficulties, if they would not arise. But one way of understanding, kind of trying to be avoiding the difficulties. Our situation in samsara anyway is full of difficulties. And I found one example of somebody in quite deep difficulty. And I want to use it to illustrate our inquiry. It is the myth of Sisyphus. If you know the mythology, this Greek hero, actually he had tied death, and therefore nobody was dying anymore. Nobody was going to the underworld, to the netherworld anymore. And Pluto, the lord of the netherworld, was not so happy because nobody was coming to visit him anymore. So he had to free death, and then he condemned Sisyphus to push a rock on the top of a mountain, and the rock rolled down, and he had to push his rock to the top of the mountain for the eternity. No time limit. It's quite a conditioned situation. Seems that but a little bit like in samsara, trying to bring some happiness and it doesn't work. We try again and again and again, and sometimes maybe we stay a bit longer than it seems in this myth, you know, on the top of the mountain, and it run again. So he seems to be a good illustration of a situation of bondage, and we may imagine that how much in the mind of Sisyphus we would like to escape. How much we dream about something else, you know, rather than this very, very narrow situation, without any hope of any freedom from that stage. And Camus, speaking about Sisyphus, he makes very weird remarks. He said that we have to imagine Sisyphus happy and free. He said the absurd allows Sisyphus to be happy. It is the nature of this hero to efface himself. So what does he mean? Then we have this very precise situation of much conditioning and a very narrow situation. And then Camus' reading said we have to imagine this hero free and happy. Says another thing. He said Sisyphus, a man who still work, but uselessly, deprived of the work of time. So the only way for Sisyphus in this difficult situation, the only way for him to be free, the only way for him to be happy, is not to look for meaning. If he is trying to find a meaning in what he is doing, then he will never find a meaning, and he may always try to look for a meaning. If he is clinging to the notion that there could be a meaning, then he is bound. If he is bound to the notion of time, then he will suffer very much. if you start to count how many times he has gone, anyway, there's no end to his counting because it's for eternity. So his freedom can only come when he will not grasp at any notion of meaning, any notion of time, of usefulness, any hope. Pluto in his condemnation was very kind with Sisyphus because he could have said for 1,000 years, for 2,000 years, and Sisyphus will be waiting. And that will be the best bondage. But he says for eternity, therefore he has no choice. He has to find his freedom right there, in his situation. He finds it in the uselessness of his work, in not clinging to the notion of time, in giving himself to the notion of the absurd. And the absurd, according to Camus, is the absence of concept, is that which cannot be expressed by words or thoughts. He says, it is that what one perceives when one is looking back, like looking back at consciousness, and there is nothing there. So that the absurd, something that cannot be grasped, something which is not meaningful or meaningless, but something which is beyond any possibility of meaning. So we understand if Sisyphus in his situation was trying to avoid his situation, see the context is that it is not possible to avoid it, then he will be fighting, and for him there will be no freedom. There will be just a situation of the deepest suffering. Now, luckily in his situation, there was no hope at all. No small reward. I don't think he was getting more food if he had pushed more the stone to the top of the mountain. So since there was no hope for anything, he was left with the only possibility to find freedom within the experience itself. The only possibility, if he is pushing the rock, without any notion of usefulness of time, in the fullness of the experiencing, as Camus said, it is in the nature of this hero to efface himself. He himself disappeared. He disappeared in the fullness, in the intimacy of his experience. There is no more Sisyphus. I imagine no more rock, no more mountain. Not because he has tried to imagine them away. Maybe he could have developed concentration and done that without... But not because of that. Because giving himself completely to the intimacy of the experience. From this intimacy, then he effaces himself. And there is his own freedom. He doesn't free himself. His own nature is freedom. But only if he does not try to avoid his situation. Only when he fully experiences what he is experiencing in full intimacy. If you wish, the world disappears from the intimacy of his experience, not because he is looking away. If he effaces himself, it is because he is fully experiencing. He is fully pushing the rock. And if you wish, in this awareness, nothing more appears. It disappears, everything disappears. Because of the quality of intimacy. Not because of the wish to eliminate, to negate something. If he had negated something, that may work for some time, but this thing will be waiting for him. When he understands deeply, with intimacy, and at this time he's free. So I think it's a fantastic example about the situation in samsara, yet being free. Not because somebody has taken the rock away, not because somebody has flattened the mountain, but because he's assuming completely the situation, and he understands it completely, deeply. So the tendency that one may have to speak about voidness or emptiness, whatever the word one may be using, in believing that it is something away, different from the world of appearance, from the world in which we are living, that is misleading. It is only the intimate reality of the world we are living. The unconditioned is the intimate reality of the world of conditioning. It is not something behind, in front, or above, or whatever. I think that what it meant when it meant that there is no duality between the past and the aim. Mean that the unconditioned nature is not something outside of our conditioned situation. We can only understand that if we are willing to experience with intimacy. If we are trying to push away, to manipulate, then we are just promoting the reality of the conditional world. As long as we believe that manipulation, doing transformation, can help. It is giving true reality to those aspects. In the text about meditation, often it is mentioned that one has to be free of hope and fear, wanting to get something or pushing away. And we see that the situation of Sisyphus, when I said he was lucky in his sense that there was no hope for him, so there was no even not the possibility for hope and nothing to do. So the situation was so extreme. Or it is a situation so extreme that we understand their hopes, fears, everything disappear. So his luck was the extreme of his situation. We are slightly less lucky because we have hopes that maybe we can improve a little bit, and all those small improvements keep us busy pushing the stone, you know, not understanding that improving a little bit, finding a better road to push the stone up, doesn't help so much, you know. Don't want to go too much in detail now in this aspect, but that's why in the Heart Sutra it is said form is emptiness and emptiness is form. They are not disconnected, they are not unrelated. One is not here and the other there. If one were to understand the emptiness as getting rid of. Maybe I will speak more about that another time. So we may just sit for a few minutes in silence. Tonight I'd like to guide you through the practice of Tonglen. We have spoken already about that earlier, and I'd like to go more in details about the practice. First, let's reflect for a short time on the motivation. So to practice meditation in order to awaken, to be able to lead all sentient beings to awakening. So to feel this motivation within ourselves, that it is not only for our own practice, but really to be able to reach all the qualities and wisdom which is necessary to guide other sentient beings to ultimate freedom. So let's reflect for a little while.